The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Rifleman. NRA President Wayne LaPierre was on Face the Nation yesterday, making claims spurious, misleading, ad hoc, and irrelevant a few times. There wasn't really a logical fallacy that went unexplored. Now, at one point, he said this.
Well, I do think this. I mean, if we could legislate morality, we would have done it long ago. I mean,
which is a good argument against doing away with all the rape laws and the embezzlement laws and the drunk driving laws. In fact, laws. So you can't use regulations or laws to fight that which is immoral. And yet later in the interview, he said this.
Nobody should be forced to face evil with empty hands.
Add it all up, you get the distinct impression that Wayne LaPierre does not believe in laws. So therefore, it is strange that the NRA is so effective at manipulating the government when they clearly do not believe in the ability of the government to do anything, the basic job of the government, or perhaps governance. It is like someone who is not a heliocentric being named to be in charge of NASA. That's happening, by the way. The NRA, I guess, believes in anarchy, that the world is anarchic, and that the only thing between you and death is whatever you put in your hands. Stick, rock, gun, hopefully a gun. I reject this. I think we all pretty much reject this. And if we don't, why are you not living off the grid or taking up arms as a mercenary in Somalia? Anyway, the bottom line with this ridiculous argument is, of course, Wayne LaPierre wins and we all lose. On the show today, I spiel about the EPA and how it's not really peeing the E. But first, he's an actor, he's a singer, he's a star of Broadway and screen. His name is Jason Kravitz, and he has a one-man show that he doesn't do a lot of prep for. I think you'll enjoy. Jason Kravitz, you know Jason Kravitz. I mean, it depends what circles you travel in. You might know him from The Practice. You might know him from, well, I identify him to my friends as he's Kimmy Schmidt's lawyer. Done. That takes care of it. But once you see the face, the punim, as his people say, you know exactly who he is.
Oh, my God.
Now, I saw Mr. Kravitz in a small cabaret setting where he's doing an improv cabaret show called Off the Top. And I knew I'd like it, but I was mesmerized by it. So I needed to bring him in to talk about the mechanics of improvising cabaret. Jason, thank you for coming in.
Hey, really great to be here, Mike.
So I know you from TV. There's not that many musicals on TV, blessedly, I would say. But are you more of a musical comedy guy than I ever knew?
I grew up in the musical theater. I did musical theater in high school, and I did musical theater in college. And yeah, I've been on Broadway. I did the Broadway.
So with this, okay, now cabaret is, yeah. I mean, it's kind of a genre, but what it really is Broadway, torch songs, mm-hmm. and the American Songbook.
Sure.
And those are all, and the odd thing is those are all songs or genres that I like. But if you call something cabaret, I feel a little allergic to it.
Everybody does. And I think that's one of the reasons that I started doing this particular show because people love cabaret. And I've seen, you know, a ton of cabaret in my time. A lot of friends have done it. I've never done it mm-hmm. before this. When it's done really well, it can be really fantastic. Yeah. And then there's other times where it is what everybody thinks of it as, which is incredibly self-indulgent.
Yes.
And I kind of wanted to exploit that aspect of it. Pick a character out of thin air from the audience and tell the story of that character's life in song in an hour.
Thank you for being here, everybody. Oh, I'm so glad to have you here. I am Friends Larkin of Kansas City. We got a lot of songs to get to tonight. I know you all came out to hear your favorites. My favorites, too. We're going to get to as many of them as we can. But, of course, we're going to start with our number one hit that went all the way to the top of the charts back in 1985. You're playing it right now. Of course, you know what it's called. It's called, of course, it's called Here and Gone. That's what it's called. It's called Here and Gone. It's one of my favorites. And it goes a little something like this. I've been here and gone. Oh, so many times it seems like I was just here, but that sometimes you know it's true. You keep traveling on and on, but as for me, you see me here. But
it is, and I said this to my girlfriend when we left. You know what that was? That was a masterclass in insincerity.
Well, gee, thank you, I think. Yeah.
Well, you're okay, so how it works is you're playing a character, and right. The character, everything about the character changes, including the name. And how would you, I don't want to step on too much, but is there one naming convention? Like, I think it's what your porn star name is, your dog's name plus the street you grew up in.
Right,
so what
right.
is the character? What is the
way they get
name?
The character name is the middle name of somebody in the audience, usually a man, and the street that one of the audience members grew up on.
Okay,
and then that's the name, and then the place they're from is where somebody else in the audience grew up, and so that everything about that informs the character, what the character is going to be about, and how that character grew up, and where they went in their life.
Right. So if it were Harry S. Truman, it would be S. Forth.
S.
Grew up
Forth.
On Forth.
Yeah. Well, you know, I
did. It doesn't always work.
It doesn't. Well, I did get recently. My name was Seth 23rd Street, and you just had to go with it. And I think what I said was my grandparents came over from the old country. When they said, "What's your name?" they thought they said, "Where are you staying?" So I ended up, that was their last name, 23rd Street.
So you get assigned your name, mm-hmm. and then the audience fills out a questionnaire,
right.
And you create songs based on these questions.
Right. I usually ask people to fill out a card that has five or six different suggestions from a place, word of advice, words to live by, the last text you received, things like mm-hmm. that. And those turn into song titles and other things during the show.
How did you come up with the questionnaire?
I think I just went back and looked at a lot of songs that I had been seeing in cabarets and other parts of the American Songbook even. And so I looked at names of songs. And I said, you know what? These songs have a lot in common. There's place songs.
Right.
And there's songs that are a little cliche, some words that you've heard in the past, you know, don't take any wooden nickels.
Don't rain on my parade.
Don't rain on my parade. Little
someone
phrases.
To look over me.
Exactly. Yes. And so I started really finding that each song fit into different categories. So I figured given that amount of material, that amount of information, I could find songs out of that easily.
There's a song about puppy love and its aftermath by a guy named Jason Robert Brown. And the song is called "What Are You Doing Yom Kippur?" yeah. One of my favorites. For you guys. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Thursday, 4 o'clock, and I'm off to Hebrew school. I haven't been there ever since the beginning of the weekend. There is this girl in class, she's really cute and has the loveliest of hair and blue eyes and the loveliest of cheeks. And I went up to her and I said to her, "What's up, girl? You know I want to know the truth. How you doing on Yom Kippur? 'Cause I like to fast with you."
Is it that your genius is so transcendent, or is this in some way an indictment of the genre itself? That it's so, I'm not going to say cliched, but formulaic, that on someone who's well-schooled can perform something that really sounds 85% of the way there. And I am not blowing smoke up your tuchus when I say that four or five of those songs are better than four or five songs on Broadway right now. Just flat out better. Sub them into the show.
Wow, that's pretty good. That's a nice compliment. I don't know if it's genius, it's panic. What I wanted to do in doing the show was give myself something really scary to do. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been doing television, film, and theater, and I've been blessed to be able to do enough of those that it's starting to settle in. You start to relax into it a little bit. So I wanted to find something really frightening, something like a tightrope walk or a magic trick that I could be part of. And as opposed to seeing a Hamilton parody or there's a lot of musical parodies out there, and some of them are really great.
Yeah.
And I take nothing away from those. But there's a suggestion at the beginning and it kind of moves from there. Mine is more of a collaboration with the audience in a lot of ways, because I do have this fishbowl full of suggestions on stage, and I'm constantly reaching in and getting the suggestions in the moment. And so I'm constantly being informed by the audience of what to do. So I feel like it's a collaboration. It's not just me up there being this, and I'm a genius here. I'm kind of like standing there going, challenge me. Come on, give me something. I want to try this.
Is a good suggestion for you one that's open enough to go anywhere, or when I saw you, or to finish the question, one with extreme specificity? Because when I saw you, you asked an audience member what her father did for a living, and he was like, in quality control at General Electric. And I'm like, this is death.
No.
But the actual mundane nature of it made it delightful.
Of course. Yeah. Sometimes it really depends on the song. Sometimes something as specific as Victorian Arasur or the quality control expert gives you, you can really dig into that one thing.
I spend my time with the down and out. Somewhere back in old town, in the unemployment line, I sat myself down, that's it, and I saw this man just there with a grin upon his face. I said, how can you smile like that? Don't you miss the race? He sat in that place. He said, I used to be in human resources. I used to be in human resources. I used to be in human resources. I would do the little life insurance, health insurance. Can I get a little assurance, man?
Is it an indictment or is it a compliment to the genres of music that you're doing that just off the top of your head, you can get 85% of the way there?
Well, I think 85 is really generous. I'll sometimes listen to the songs again and just review what I did, which is very difficult to do because all you see is like, oh, I should have said this. Mm-hmm. I should have said this. And I think, oh, this is a bunch of pretty decent ideas for songs that could be fleshed out. And, you know, I'm writing one song in that genre. A lot of these people write 30 songs in that genre. So I don't know if it's an indictment. I think they're like a lot of things. It's an homage. It's a love letter, but it's also a parody. You know, I think if you love cabaret, you'll find a lot in this that you recognize that you'll laugh at and you'll find funny and enjoy. If you hate cabaret, I think this is the show for you.
Has doing this changed your appreciation, either up or down, of the established greats in the field, of Sondheim and Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Oh, it's improved it. I mean, I had to study these guys, and you look at the intricacy in what they're doing, and you go, wow. Especially when you go to like the great greats, like the Sondheims, and you look and you go, you're not only telling a story, you're telling an emotional arc. You're really digging into the heart of this character. And I try to do that in a funny way, but I try to, improvise in the same vein as he would be doing, digging into that character. I'm nowhere near the depth that he would be able to do it. But no, it's definitely made me appreciate them more.
And no one writes songs about difficult relationships better than Mr. Stephen Sondheim. And there's a song that most people don't know. He actually threw it in the trash, and it was found and ironed out and auctioned off at my son's school auction. And I bought it, and so I own the rights, and I'm the only one who gets to sing it. And it's called Up Your Nose with a Rubber Hose. And one of my favorite. He wrote it somewhere after Sunday in the Park. And assassins, so he was in a darker mood. This is a song about love. Up your nose with a rubber hose. I've worked in the emergency room for over 20 years now. I've been the doctor on call. And when can I be on call to your heart? Your Your heart is bleeding, and only I can repair it. Only I know what to do. If you please come into my operating room, and I will heal you. I can heal you, my love. Lie back on my table. Lie back and breathe in slowly. And now, up your nose with this rubber hose. Let the rubber hose go down your trachea into your lungs and around.
Do you think with these kind of songs, cabarets are not the only place you would see it? You might see it if there were still a Borscht Belt, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. Could you do that show? Could you tweak the show to be the Borscht Belt version
of
this?
Oh, sure. I think that I was born to do the Borscht Belt version of this. Yeah, the Tumbler version of this is one thing, and the guy at the corporate event is another thing, and the small party.
The charity benefit.
The charity benefit guy.
That would be good.
It's very easily
tweakable. Come back. That would be great if you do a special show and say it's a charity benefit, and then you invent what the charity is right there. It shouldn't be too heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely not something actually going on.
Definitely. I mean,
reptile awareness.
That I've done. No, I could do that. I honestly think that this, what I'm doing with the songs is the same thing I'm doing with the story. You know, this is kind of a cabaret story, which is a very self-indulgent, you know, behind the music story. You know, I was started this way and I got big and then I dropped out and here's where I come back. That's got
talk about structure.
Shape.
Talk about, you know, a standard
there
format.
There is a standard format within that. Those tent poles of that story come all the different genres of music and how you tell that story. If you're doing a charity benefit for reptiles, it would be a different structure. But yeah,
probably the guy would still do that story and then just pivot a little bit. But, you know, it's really all about the snakes.
It's about the snakes. Let's talk. Can we get back to the iguanas? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make it about me.
My eyes start to mist because I'm a herpetologist. All right. There you go.
You're already sad. Why don't you join me?
I want to. Jason Kravitz is it's a schedule that I've tried to memorize. What is it? The second Saturday?
Yeah, it's a weird one. It's the second Saturday of every month at the Duplex down in the Village, the old Duplex. And the next one's October 14th, 7 o'clock at night.
All right, so there you go. You have to be in New York City to see this, and it's an intimate setting, but it's worth it.
Can I give you the web address to find it? It's offthetop.nyc. It's easy.
And there are some clips there, too. Thank you, Jason Kravitz. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. It was great.
And now the spiel. The war is over. Not the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. The other war. The war against an enemy that is remorseless, powerful, and smudgy. The war on coal. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt was in Hazard, Kentucky yesterday.
I'll be signing a proposed rule to withdraw the so-called Clean Power Plan of the past administration and thus begin the effort to withdraw that rule.
Folks in Hazard, Kentucky have never seen such a sight. A man in a blue checkered coat had just shown up, what with old Mitch. Old Mitch had become quite a big shot up the road in Washington. And checkered coat man Scott was there to announce that the clean power plant had gone the way of the backyard still and the outdoor latrine. So we welcome back coal, anthracite, which is the glorious third part of the triumvirate, along with moonshine and shotguns that gave this place its character and its soot. Now, why'd the government ever... I'm, by the way, doing the voiceover guy from the Dukes of Hazzard, if you didn't know. Anyway, I'll continue. So why'd the government ever gone with the clean coal plan in the first place? Was it because regulating emissions of carbon dioxide is something the EPA is obligated to do? The Supreme Court says so. But here in Hazzard, Kentucky, we don't like them fancy lawyers in black robes, unless they start off in white robes and pick up a little bit of coloring from being outside. I mentioned the soot, right? So the EPA administrator, in his checkered coat,
He talked about why the last government wanted this clean coal rule. Was it because of global warming? Was it because of the estimated 10,000 cases of childhood asthma attacks the rule could stop every year? No siree. Here's why the government wanted a rule in the first place: to regulate coal.
When you think about what that rule meant, that rule really was about picking winners and losers.
As rules often do. I'm no longer the narrator from Dukes of Hazzard. You might argue that I never really was. But rules. Those who violate rules will be penalized. They will lose. They will lose that point. They will lose that down. Perhaps they will lose the contest. Tangible example. The Lions got the ball to the Falcons' one-yard line, but the receiver's knee was down. By rule, the Falcons won. I know football has become very political, apparently very liberal, but it does seem that rules function by saying what is permissible and what is not permissible, and if something is not permissible, then the unpermissible thing loses. It is not allowed. This is just in terms of language. Another example. Well, Connor gets ice cream because he did his homework, but Scott, you didn't do your homework, so you can have ice cream. That is the rule. What do you think about that, Scott?
You know, regulatory power should not be used by any regulatory body to pick winners and losers.
I get the feeling he could have stopped after the words "by any regulatory body." Could have ended it there. But I guess the rule was picking winners and losers. Guy without black lung, winner. Guy with black lung, loser. But if the rule doesn't regulate, why even refer to it as a regulatory power? Scott Pruitt has an answer.
What we ought to be about as an agency, and this is not the most profound statement you may hear.
I believe you so far.
But regulations ought to make things regular.
He is right. Regulations from the Latin regula, rule. Regular comes from the Latin regularis, from regula, rule. Same root word. Rules, he is saying, ought to be governed by rules. And that is why I am ripping up this previous plan, because I believe in being regular. It's all part of my boss's strategy and hat, Make American Regular Again. To that end, we have new policies in a number of areas in this administration. We're canceling the Iran treaty. Why? Because treaties ought not to be a treat. We're upending the Affordable Care Act. Why? Because we care, so we can afford to act. We're punting on DACA. Why? It's right there in the name. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So we're deferring action. It's funny with these speeches. You come for the policy, you stay for the textual analysis. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency continued.
You know, as we do our business at the agency now, as the leader indicated, we're getting back to the basics.
Protecting the environment?
The first thing we're starting with is doing our work consistent with rule of law. You know, it's Congress. It's Leader McConnell. It's the U.S. House of Representatives. It's Congress that passes legislation that gives us direction, that gives us our orders as far as how we administer.
That last part was very cogent. In ways, they didn't want to use fossil fuels, so they used the authority to do otherwise. In other words, this authority to do otherwise, you know what that's called? There's a word for that. Regulations. They used regulations to protect the environment. Here we have the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, who not only disagrees with the purpose of his agency, but the name, who not only disagrees with the mission of his department regulating, but the word. But he knew how to appeal to the crowd with these words.
No better place to make that announcement than in Hazzard, Kentucky.
Hazzard, synonym, danger, risk, peril, threat, and menace. Yeah, that is kind of appropriate. That's it for today's show. The Gist, Dan Schrader, Mary Wilson. They are producers. Let me think about this. There once was a guy, his name was Schrader. He'd show up now or later, and he's producing The Gist. Producing The Gist. And there's a girl named Mary Wilson. She'd thrill you, then she'd kill some. What's she doing? She's producing The Gist, 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 Gisty Gist. I could go low, or I could go high. I could mention a guy named Steve Lickteig. He's executive producer of Slate Podcast, which is to say in a long roundabout way, he's producing The Gist, The Gist, The Gist, Gist, Gist. Peru, de Peru, du Peru. Sounds better with an accompanist. And if I could sing. Thanks for listening.